Hello, welcome to the Wilderness Medic Podcast. My name is Daniel, and today I'm joined by Mr. Hugh Jones, the CEO and founder of the Virtual Doctors Charity. Virtual Doctors Charity is based in south of the UK, and it exists essentially to provide telemedical advice to rural health centres in Zambia. It's a great charity, and I've had the privilege of being the medical director since the start of this year. We've split this podcast into two parts. Part one will look a bit at the history of the Virtual Doctors, how we came into being, and part two will look more at the COVID-19 pandemic, particularly how this will impact on countries such as Zambia, and looking at how we as a charity can respond to this.
Welcome to the Wilderness Medic Podcast. Check out our website at www.thewildernessmedic.com.
Expedition resources, Wilderness Medicine blog, and much more.
So today I'm joined by my colleague Hugh Jones, and we're going to be talking about the Virtual Doctors, which is a charity that I've been involved with probably for about 18 months now, I think. So Hugh, thanks for joining me. I will probably put this out on my Wilderness Medic podcast, but also onto the Virtual Doctors podcast as well. We thought it would be good to talk a bit about what the Virtual Doctors is, how it came to start, and then how things have progressed, and I suppose most importantly, its relevance at the moment during the coronavirus pandemic.
Thanks, Daniel. Yeah, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
So I guess to start with, do you want to tell people listening a bit about your background living in Africa, and then how we kind of got to this stage that we're at now?
Certainly, yeah. So I suppose I first went out to Zambia in the late 1980s. I worked predominantly in rural areas. It was actually, I started up in the eastern province of Zambia, so up in the areas close to the Malawi border, in the sort of northeast part of the country. And most of the time there was spent living and working in rural areas, and I built up some very strong and close relationships with the communities who lived in those areas and witnessed many of the challenges they faced, particularly around primary health care, and seeing what I felt at the time objectively was a lot of unnecessary morbidity and mortality from very easily treatable conditions. And then I had a couple of sort of very challenging personal experiences, and it culminated with an experience of picking up a man and his wife who were trying to get to a hospital, and she was suffering from prepartum hemorrhaging. She lost a lot of blood, and she passed away in the vehicle I was in. And that was a bit of a wake-up call, a sort of a slap in the face with a wet fish, to sort of think, well, could I do something? You know, I thought, I'm not a doctor, sure, I'm just Hugh. Yeah. You know, I'm out here in the middle of nowhere, and what could I do to help? So I suppose that was the sowed the seeds for trying to want to do something. And at the same time, I knew a lot of doctors based in the cities in Zambia, also neighbouring Malawi, and also in the UK. And when I sort of share these experiences with them, they all sort of said, we'd love to help, we just can't go and work or live in Zambia. So the question was, how can we connect the two? How can we connect these doctors offering their medical expertise free to perhaps a rural health centre in Zambia, where they could help them to walk them through complicated patient cases?
And it certainly sounds like, obviously, that particular case had a huge impact on you. It sounds very, very traumatic as well. And you mentioned that there was also a lot of sort of more chronic and easily treatable conditions that you came across as well. What sort of things?
I think certain sort of skin diseases getting out of hand. I would say certain conditions that perhaps just a simple set of antibiotics or a very simple intervention could have mitigated the condition turning to morbidity or mortality. And I think that you've got in Zambia a lot of health facilities manned by clinical officers. So clinical officers probably on par with an advanced nurse practitioner in the UK, and nurses, and then outreach workers going out into the communities. But you very rarely find a doctor in a rural area, but they're mainly based in the urban centres. And so really, if they had the ability to be able to share the details of a complicated case, because I think they really have two options if they're faced with a complicated case, is either offer suboptimal advice or refer the patient to a hospital and or secondary care. And often these hospitals are good sort of maybe up to 50, 100 kilometres away. And they often the patients need to get to them themselves. It's very rarely an ambulance. They have to foot the costs of transport, either a minibus or a taxi. And if that's not available, and as I experienced, I found a man who was trying to cycle his wife. She was heavily pregnant, prepartum hemorrhaging, and he was the nearest hospital 60 miles away. And they didn't stand a chance. Yeah. And there was no alternative because the rural health facility could not deal with a case like that. She needed emergency care and she needed blood. But I have to say, there's not a lot telemedicine could have done to save her life, but it's those sort of events that you witness that act as a catalyst to make you want to do something. And that was a catalyst for me, at least. Yeah.
And I suppose since then, it's so it started off, didn't it, with one volunteer doctor sort of giving telemedical advice by satellite, wasn't it, initially from New York? Is that right?
That's correct, yes. We got permission from the Ministry of Health to carry out a trial of telemedicine around about 2007. So it was a good sort of 10 years after I had this the difficult experience, but I had more time in my hands and I really wanted to try and do something. And we had a rural health centre in a village called Chinyanya, which is in Kafue district. So it's about 60 kilometres southeast of Lusaka, but still very rural. And we had VSAT for the internet. We were using desktop computers and we had just off-the-shelf commercial telemedicine software and one doctor, volunteer doctor in New York. And then we slowly expanded from that to six sites. And we had doctors in the UK, South Africa, and New Zealand, Australia. And it very quickly became apparent that the systems we were using were not really adequate for a low resource setting. The VSAT was very expensive. It was very expensive to set it up, and it was costing us a lot of money for the bandwidth on a monthly basis. Yeah. And then actually something quite comical happened. So to get it set up, it's a lot of logistics. We had to get a team of technicians to come in, set it up, and attach this pretty large satellite dish on the side of the Royal Health Centre. And then they had to synchronise it with the satellite. They had specialist equipment to do that. And then they left. And about 2 days later, a very large bird of prey. You get these big birds of prey in Africa. It's one called a battler eagle. And it's now known as a short-tailed snake eagle, but battler sounds better. And the battler sat, obviously perched on this dish, and I think some children had also been playing with it and kind of pushed it out of sync. So we had to wait a week for these guys to come back in. So we thought, well, this is really going anywhere. There were regular power cuts. Zambia is heavily reliant on hydro power for its electricity. And there's a lot of often power cuts when there isn't enough power for sort of industry and various other key parts of the economy. And then the commercial telemedicine software itself was very clumpy and complicated to use, not easy to use. And so we really needed to do something else.
Yeah, I guess this sort of telemedical and all these things were very much in their infancy at that point, weren't they? That was probably before mobile phone networks had got to Zambia, or maybe they were just starting out. Is that right, do you think?
Well, mobile phone networks first came into Zambia around about, I'd say they were started to build up really in the sort of mid to late 90s, but very much only really in the cities. As the country became, I suppose there was wealth, a bit more wealth floating around, and necessity, more towers were going up. And it was quite funny because one day we'd gone through all this sort of complicated and challenging, expensive sort of process of putting in this VSAT. And suddenly I was standing in this village one day and I looked at my mobile phone and suddenly I had signal. and data. And I hadn't realized in the week since I'd been there, a tower had gone up about 20 kilometers away. It was just on the fringe of the network. And that was a bit of a paradigm shift for us. We realized now, you know, the network really is spreading. We need to ditch the VSATs and work out how we can use the mobile phone network.
Yeah, because a small device in a clinical officer's hand is much different than having to have a satellite dish put on the side of a building, isn't it? And do you think that's the time that the expansion really started to sort of ramp up, and you were getting more sort of volunteer doctors in the UK involved as well?
That's right. So we're getting more interest, more volunteer doctors, and around about the same time. So we're now talking about 2014-15. We carried out a pretty comprehensive monitoring evaluation study of the six sites we've been working with, and we came to two very key points came out of that. Firstly, from the clinical officer, because we pretty much went straight to there and said, okay, well, what would help you as a clinical officer, or even some of the senior nurses, what would help you make best use of a service like this? And I have to point out that we didn't just sort of come along with an idea or a paradigm and say to them, this is a really good idea, you should use this. The demand came from them. We were very careful to ensure that we weren't pushing something on them that they didn't really need. And they said, we need to talk to a doctor. It doesn't matter where they are. If we can talk to a doctor, it would help us considerably. So that's quite key to point out. And then they also said, so what we really need is something that is very easy to use, very easy to learn to use, and something we can fit in during the very busy patient consultation period of the day. So they're probably getting anywhere between 80 to 150 patients a day.
Isn't it? And it can be anything coming through the door as well. It's that kind of that uncertainty as well, isn't it? Definitely.
It certainly is. A lot of patients coming through, and you know, quite a diversity of cases. And really, so it had to be something they could use during that, not where they're having to sort of fill in data later down the line. And secondly, they said, you know, why don't you use smartphones? We know how to use them. They're pretty intuitive pieces of equipment to use, and you can buy them here in Zambia. So that was, amongst many other things, that sort of really stood out. And then we went to the volunteer doctors at the time, and we said, I suppose it boiled it down to what's the bare minimum of information that you require as a doctor to formulate an opinion on diagnosis and then offer treatment advice. And amongst all the other information, that's what drove the design towards an app on a smartphone. We were very fortunate to find a group of volunteer developers in the UK who built the app and the cases database, which the doctors use to answer cases. And they're still doing that to this very day. They've been developing and advancing it, working on the backlog, fixing bugs. Now we have a very robust, easy to use app. It takes roughly, I suppose some clinical officers may say have different experiences with it, but on average, about less than 5 minutes to fill in a case.
Yeah, and as a volunteer myself, when you receive the information, it comes through to sort of a specific website, and it's all very easy to use, and then you sort of type a case back. And it sort of starts a dialogue with the clinical officers, and it can be really helpful, I think. So if we kind of fast forward to present day, how are we at the moment in terms of our volunteers? I think it was around 100 when we last checked. Is that right?
That's right. So we have now around about 100 volunteer doctors. Most of them are GNC UK based doctors. Many working within the NHS or general practice, and we have some in the UK. We have, in fact, one of our most senior doctors is on our board. He's a district health director in Mazibuko district, Dr. Falan Waba. We have some other doctors in Zambia. And actually, we're trying to recruit more volunteer doctors in Zambia, but the majority of them are in the UK, yes.
And I guess that comes back to sort of what we were saying earlier about the number of doctors per capita, really, and how it really is quite different in Zambia.
That's correct. I mean, we're looking at the statistics. I think it's something along the lines of one doctor for every 10,000 people, whereas in the UK it's more around the sort of 350, one doctor to 350 patients. So it is far more challenging, and still the majority of the population are rural-based. Zambia is still very much a rural-based economy, and that's where you find less doctors. And so this is where it's very helpful if you can provide expert medical consultations remotely.
Absolutely. And I remember you telling me a great story about sort of one particular case where it was obviously it was telemedicine, and we do all the cases rather than in real time. We do it on sort of messaging basis. But this case almost did unfold in real time, didn't it, despite that?
That's right. Yes, it was a case. It was more of a sort of an acute case. The majority of cases the doctors are dealing with are chronic, but this is a good example of a case which was needed very rapid consultation. So this was a 20 month year old boy who was with his parents. His mother was carrying him on her back, and they were struck by lightning. This is sort of during the peak of the rainy season when you do get a lot of thunderstorms and lightning. And very sadly, his parents died on the spot, and he survived. He was picked up by passers-by and taken to a rural health centre nearby. This is in Kolomo district, so in southern province of Zambia. And they were really, he was in a very poor condition. He was obviously in great shock, and he had very bad burns, I think 30% burns. And they sent the case to a paediatrician in the UK, and he actually happened to pick it up. So it was just a little late at night, and he was just happened to be off duty. He's a consultant paediatric surgeon in Birmingham, and very experienced. And he immediately picked up on it and pretty much walked them through how to stabilize the boy. He did advise them that, you know, in the UK, anything over 2% burns on a child would be an immediate requirement to go to a pediatrics burn unit, but they were a very long way from a hospital. And strangely enough, they, in order to try to prevent fluid loss, he asked them if they had any cling film. Now, for a rural health centre in Zambia to have cling film is very unusual, and they did, and that created the second skin, helped prevent fluid loss. They got him on an intravenous drip, stabilised him, and they managed eventually to get him to a hospital in Livingston, many, many hours away, which has a burns unit, and the boy survived. So that's a very powerful example remote consultation like that.
So that brings us to the end of part one of the collaboration between the Wilderness Medic and the Virtual Doctors. If you want to listen to part two, where we focus more on COVID-19 and the impact that this is potentially going to have within Zambia, you can find this in the next episode. If you've enjoyed listening to our podcast, then check out our website, www.thewildernessmedic.com. If you're interested in being a guest on a future episode or writing a blog for us, then do get in touch, and don't forget to follow us on social media. Until next time, take care.